It's Monday night.
I've been in the game a long time. When a catcher catches a ball and it's strike three, you call the guy out. It's that simple, isn't it?
And if it's Monday, it's the knee jerks.
I'm not going to sit here and rip umpires, but you saw what you saw, clearly saw what you saw. I just saw it for the 10th time. Write it and say something once in a while. Have the nerve to say something.
Detroit Sports Talk with attitude.
Attitude, OD! 1, 2, 3!
Attitude!
Coming up tonight, will Big Al guess whose birthday it is? Who are the jerks of the week? What will Eno rant about now? The answers coming up next. Two guys who know Detroit sports. The voice of reason, Greg Eno and Big Al Beaton.
Monday night, December 16th, 2013. That means it's time for the Knee Jerks Detroit Sports Talk with Eno and Big Al. I'm the Big Al of the equation, Al Beaton of BlessYouBoys.com, where I'm managing editor. I get together every week with the man who called the voice of reason, Mr. Excitement, the man who knows a lot of things about a lot of things, and Mr. Old School. And he's also heavy into electric football after our conversation last week. And that is Greg Eno of GregEno.com, Bleacher Reports. And numerous other places on the web where you can find them all at GregEno.com. Greg, boy, it's been quite a week around here.
If I still owned an electric football set, you can be damn sure that I would have dragged it out after last week's interview with Earl Shores.
Yes.
And I would have dragged those players out and looked at them, and what a great trip down memory lane that was last week with Earl. And I wanted to also thank him. I didn't get a chance to thank him then. I'll thank him now, even though he's not here, for all the positive publicity he gave the Knee Jerks on his website and on his Facebook page and on the Unforgettable Buzz of his Facebook page. It really, pumped the podcast. So I wanted to thank Earl for that as well. I am Greg Eno from GregEno.com, BleacherReport.com, and various other and sundry places on the internet. Tonight we have Adam Biggers. It's the third Monday of the month, so it's time for Adam Biggers to make an appearance. We haven't spoken to Adam in quite a while, so we've got lots to talk about college basketball, the Rose Bowl with Michigan State, and what have you. So that's coming up very shortly. Right now, no guest scheduled for the 23rd, so we may just be flying solo, Al and I. As we record this podcast, it's Sunday night, so no Lions to talk about in terms of any games that they've played, because, of course, they play Monday night this week, but there is still some football games that we will talk about. It did affect the Lions in terms of their playoff standing. We'll get into that. Al's got a lot of stuff going on with the Tigers and the Red Wings and all sorts of stuff. And the Pistons, some fond memories of the game played 30 years ago. But before we do any of that, it's time for a game we like to call Whose Birthday Is It, Maestro?
Happy birthday to you.
How we play this game. I give Al a clue or two or three of an individual whose birthday it is today in the world of sports, and if Al correctly guesses that clue within the if he correctly guesses that person within the first two clues, tonight he will receive a very ample stock of Hamburger Helper.
Merry damn Christmas.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Well, it's the end of the year. We're starting to run out of money here, so the gifts are getting more than cheaper. This person, Al, was born on this date in 1951. Unfortunately, he passed away 2 years ago in very unfortunate and horrific circumstances. But he was born in Manchester, New Hampshire in 1951 on this date. He was a draft pick in the 1973 Major League Baseball draft by the Baltimore Orioles. And he was an all-star in 1978. And the 1979 AL Cy Young winner. That's your first clue.
This is something
I should. Might be too much, actually.
Yeah, I know. And I should know this. I'm sitting here thinking, holy crap. I know I should know this. And unfortunately, I'm so disappointed by the Hamburger Helper. It's slipping my mind. So,
it's all in your brain. You can't even get past the hamburger helper thing.
I know.
Well, there's another clue. Not to fear. There's another clue. You still have a chance to win said hamburger helper. We'll get to the second clue a little bit later on in the program. Well, joining us now is Adam Biggers from Bleacher Report, and our good friend Adam Biggers is here. It's the third Monday of the month, so it's time for an edition of Adam Rants. And tonight's rant will be involving college basketball, college football, from a Michigan State perspective, and other things as well. Adam, thanks for being here with us.
I appreciate it. I feel like I'm going to deliver my third it's been a while speech. These last few appearances have been few and far between, so I got to pack these rants.
I know. Seems like you're always the victim of a circumstance when it comes to us not doing the show, or some scheduling quirk always affects Adam, but he's with us tonight, and he's ready to rant, and so the floor, my friend, is all yours.
Well, despite the dates not being in my favor, hopefully that'll change in 2014, the listeners of the podcast are pretty familiar kind of where I stand as far as my likes and dislikes of college sports and college basketball and football to be particular. Right now, just starting off with the Michigan State Rose Bowl team, I don't think I've ever really hit the fact that, yes, I do root for the Spartans. That's just how it goes, and I know a lot of people are aware that I cover Michigan football, so it's an interesting angle. But I've been waiting since I was 6 years old. I'm gonna shed my writer hat and put on my fan hat. I've been waiting since I was six for a Rose Bowl. And to tell you the truth, I don't believe that this is actually D'Antonio's best team, believe it or not. I think the 2010 team was Kirk Cousins at quarterback was their best team. But I've been really impressed by the growth of Connor Cook. I was listening to Huge the other day, the Huge show, and he mentioned how Connor Cook, he was interviewing Izzo, mentioned how Connor Cook was laughed basically off the field the first two games, and now the guy's Big Ten championship MVP. It's just an incredible story coming from a guy, you know, filling the spot vacated by a program great, and it's not an easy job or transition by any means. And you know, I think you really got to tip your hat to the job that Connor Cook's done this year. He's still very raw, and if that's any consolation, I mean, it just shows how much better he's going to be down the road. He's nowhere near the quarterback that I think that he can become. And to be honest with you, I don't feel that he's really a top four quarterback in the Big Ten right now. He's been hot at the right moments. He's displaying a little bit better decision making. He got better as far as making the right throws, and you just see kind of a maturity with him. This matchup against Stanford, win or lose, I think it's really going to determine kind of where Michigan State goes with a quarterback. Because if you remember, Damian Terry was right there in the mix before he hurt his thumb on his throwing hand. So Damian Terry was right there on the heels of it. So I think that I don't want to say that Cook's auditioning or, you know, doing anything to keep the job. I don't want to say the job's wide open. I don't know for a fact. But from my perspective, I would view this game for Cook as a statement game to create no doubt whatsoever who the man is next year. And like I said, you really got to tip your hat to Connor Cook. He's done a phenomenal job. Mark D'Antonio's coached that team, an 8-0 finish in the Big Ten. And you just look at year by year what he's been able to do, and it's not a surprise to see him have the success. And I think anybody, Big Ten fan, even if you're a Michigan fan, if you just like the league in general, you're going to enjoy watching this team represent the league in the Rose Bowl. It's been a while, I feel like, since we've had a real Rose Bowl power, speaking from a Big Ten perspective. And I think this year's team has a great blend of defense, enough offense to combat Stanford, which is going to be a pretty similar team, except for I view Stanford as a little more explosive on the ground. And just maybe it seems like it's survived the rigors a little bit of knowing how to play at that high level. Stanford's not new to this. Michigan State is. So I think this year's Rose Bowl is going to be a great game for Michigan State. I believe it's going to be a big game for Connor Cook. And it's definitely a statement for Mark D'Antonio. And I know that you guys aren't really I don't know if you're Michigan State fans or not, which it doesn't matter, but I know you guys both follow D'Antonio, and I've always been curious kind of what you view his progress as and how you would grade it at this point.
Well, I got to tell you something. Al and I touched on this briefly last week when we talked about the win over Ohio State, and I drew the comparison between I thought it was a very apt time to compare the progression of Connor Cook versus the regression of Devin Gardner, you know, the two high-profile programs in the state of Michigan, where Devin Gardner was in September versus where Connor Cook was in September versus where they both ended up when the season ended. And my point was, and I want to get your take on this, because I feel like this it's an indictment, frankly, of the coaching that Gardner has gotten in the coaching around him that he's got in Michigan with the offense. And it's also a very good appraisal of what D'Antonio and his folks have done in East Lansing with Connor Cook, because you just look at those two guys 3 months ago, I don't know that you would have traded Devin Gardner for Connor Cook, and now I think a lot of people would. And I'm interested, Adam, from your perspective, because you're such a fervent Michigan State guy, but also cover Michigan for Bleacher Report. I'm curious to what your take is on what I just said in terms of, you know, where Devin Gardner was and where he ended up being and where Connor Cook was and where he ended up being.
Well, and you know, that's just the tip of the iceberg, because I have to think back a little bit, and I don't know if you guys remember when we talked to Michigan State last year. It wasn't because of a loss to Michigan. It was the finish, 7-6. I thought that Michigan State had maybe reached a point to where, hey, maybe it looks like Michigan is going to sneak back in there and have their run. I thought, that being said, I was wrong. The two teams flip-flopped my expectations. I thought it would be Michigan in this position and Michigan State would be, you know, fighting for a December bowl game. Now, when it comes to Cook and Gardner, you look at what Gardner did last year, and I have to point to this all the time, because especially you look at South Carolina this year. Gardner played very well against South Carolina, which was one of the better teams in the SEC, and so you can't take that away from him. You would think that the coaching staff would adapt somehow to change a game plan to put Gardner in some type of position that he could succeed. And I recently talked with Butch Wolfolk, former Michigan running back, and he pointed out to me, you know, the line, his words were, and I'm not quoting him exactly here, it's something along the lines of Jameis Winston couldn't have performed back there. So I think, you know, a lot of it, yes, there was a regression with Devin Gardner. I don't think the regression was athletically, though. I think that the regression was mentally. I think that being the number one guy this year, I mean, you're sacked 34 times. That was the third most in the FBS. Yeah. You're behind a line that's supposed to, you know, even with Lawan and Schofield, even if you just have two solid tackles to anchor those guys in the middle, it's a very young midsection of the line. There was no form of, like, continuity. I never felt like the Michigan offense. I felt like it was the Michigan offensive line against the rest of the offense. And I think really what you saw with Gardner earlier this season, he was kind of a victim of sorts of circumstances. And at one point he had, you know, 8 touchdowns and 8 interceptions, a 1-to-1 ratio through like 5 games. The year before he was 11-5. So right there is a regression in statistics. I believe that Gardner can be a good quarterback. I believe that Gardner is a great athlete. I don't know, you know, I don't know if it's a combination of coaching at Michigan or if the guy just got rattled. And I think that's a fair assessment. It's not any way trying to call out Devin Gardner and say that he can't handle it, but I'm trying to, the best I can, understand his situation. And if I were him, I wouldn't see any shame in being a little bit rattled. I mean, you never know what you're going to get. Snap after snap. There was no consistency with that line. So as a quarterback, you have a target on you. Devin Gardner is paying for, you know, the mistakes that he didn't necessarily make. Now, when you look you look at Connor Cook. He was an underdog guy. No one really expected him to do much. Gardner was fighting that, you know, that reputation of, hey, where's this five-game phenom at? You're not showing it. Cook was essentially a nobody. Right. And he comes out of nowhere, and next thing you know, Spartans can score 3 touchdowns in a game as opposed to 2. And one of those touchdowns was from the defense. So it was an agonizing start offensively for Cook. And then you start seeing, I think, the line developed well, but I think that what was a key for Cook that Gardner didn't have was that the Spartans had a run game. Cook had an out. Yeah. He had an ally back yeah. there. Gardner didn't have anything. So while yeah. I think if I had to kind of slice it up in percentages, I would say, you know, Gardner, 70% of Gardner's problems were probably self-inflicted this year, and I think that maybe mentally he wasn't able to deal with it. I know that he was banged up. I was down at Glick about a month ago, and Devin Funches said, you know, all of Gardner's injuries while we were talking, so it led me to believe, and I'm just speculating what he said, that it's not just, you know, the one that they happened to announce. This time it's turf toe. I think there was a succession of injuries that maybe went unreported, and, I mean, and just being banged up. You're playing football. You're going to get dinged and bruised every week. So yeah. I think it was just yeah. a piling of injuries. And then the 30%, the other 30%, I would definitely put on the coaching as far as the line failed, but that's a failing of coaching. I think right. I think by and far, Brady Hoke and his staff, I mean, and fail is a harsh word to use, but I think they failed their team this year. I really do. I think that they didn't use the best players available at all times. And I think that's evident by the way they were able to rush later in the year with Derek Green and Devion Smith. Why didn't you go to that to start? Why did you play the best game of your year against Ohio State with nothing on the line other than a little bit of pride?
Right. Well, it sounds like you're largely agreeing with my assessment. Let's bring Big Al in. What you got? What say you about what Adam just said?
Well, actually, I wanted to bring up with Adam what's going on in Texas with a Mac Brown resigning or retiring or being forced to exit, however you want to put it. And obviously the dream guy was going to be Nick Saban, and there were rumors all over the place. But Saban, being as smart as he is, just leveraged all that interest into a ridiculous contract for $7-plus million dollars a season over the next, like, till sometime in the next decade. But you now before the show, you mentioned that Mark D'Antonio – his name is being brought up in this. D'Antonio is, you know, as a candidate for the Texas job, you know, and obviously Texas, for many reasons, is considered the best job in the country when it comes to facilities, money being available, recruiting advantages, size of market, and things like that. But there's also the huge headaches involving an insane fan base, an even worse booster base, and an administration at Texas that is really infighting going on over there is who should be the coach. So what's your take, Adam, on Mark D'Antonio being a candidate for the Texas job and Mark D'Antonio, who has also said in the past that Michigan State was the job for him. So what do you think is going to go down?
Well, and you know what's funny about that whole story, the more that I followed it, and I think and knowing kind of how you guys feel about the cycle of news and kind of the culture of the sports reporting nowadays, it almost just – it just sickens you. Like, the more you hear it, it's a soap opera. I would say, I remember being a little kid, and my babysitter always watched, like, General Hospital and stuff, and it's just so dramatic, it just acting. I guess they do I'm going to get cliche, they do everything bigger in Texas. And when you're on the hot seat, your seat is huge, and every rumor around you is, I mean, there was a report that Saban had accepted the job. There was a report that Mac Brown was going to step down. He refuted those reports and then stepped down. I mean, this couldn't have been any messier. I think with D'Antonio's name being mentioned, if you're Michigan State, that's just kind of a gold star on your resume.
Yeah.
The fact that even Texas is even talking about your football coach.
Right.
Or if it's not Texas, it's media members, people trying to look for a good fit. the fact that D'Antonio is even being mentioned in that sentence speaks volumes to what he's done in Michigan State. I don't think he's going anywhere. I think my personal belief is that D'Antonio and Izzo are destined to kind of just be the figureheads at Michigan State when their coaching careers are done. And Pat Narduzzi, in my mind, would be the next guy. I'd like to see them get Don Treadwell back too, but that's another topic, the offensive coordinator.
Just to step in, didn't Narduzzi turn down a head job just recently?
He did at UConn, and Narduzzi is going to be a guy who, there was that brief vacancy at Boise State, who my friend said that I resemble Chris Peterson, the coach, and I'd have to definitely disagree with that. The UConn job opening, there's going to – Narduzzi will be a guy who's mentioned for those up and coming because of his coordinator status and what he's been doing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you guys will know that. As far as anyone leaving Michigan State, I don't think Narduzzi and D'Antonio want to leave. I think that it has to be the ultimate sign for a coach and his staff to know that we are building a national relevant program. And look at this. People would like to see D'Antonio at Texas. I don't think D'Antonio, I think he's kind of cut from a similar mold as Izzo. I don't think D'Antonio would go for that political booster controlled Friday night lights, super psycho. And I'm sorry, you guys are psycho.
Yeah.
High school football fans. I really don't think that I think D'Antonio is a more laid back, family oriented kind of guy.
He's a Midwest guy. I don't see the fit either, Adam. I agree with you. When I say the fit, I mean in terms of what you just said about the culture and about the type of guy that Mark is. I mean, you know, he's a Midwest guy and he's always been in the Midwest. And Al's old enough to remember when, of course, when Bo Schembechler almost went to Texas A&M.
Exactly.
And that was close. I mean, they threw a lot of money at Bo, and he really thought about that real hard. And ultimately, he just could not leave Ann Arbor, even though he had A&M just threw a ton of money at him. And he did not, he couldn't bite. He just couldn't bite. And the thing with D'Antonio is that he's got, you know, sometimes the best moves, Al, you make, and Adam, are the ones you don't make. But like Adam also said, to be fair about this conversation, what he said also before we went on the air was that a lot of times, you know, names get tossed out there by guys who aren't really, like Adam said, not really doing any reporting. They're just throwing names out there of guys who are kind of hot, trendy guys. And Mark D'Antonio, right now, by virtue of what he did this season and what he did against Ohio State and returning Michigan State to the first Rose Bowl in 26 years, is a hot commodity right now. So his name is going to get thrown out there with not only the Texas job, but with, I'm sure, other openings. And just as Pat Narduzzi's name is going to be thrown out there because he's also kind of a hot commodity right now because of how good the defense has performed this year. So, and not just this year, but over the past several years. So I agree. Adam, anything else you want to add to your rant?
Well, I'll just have to say that despite their two-loss record, I think when hot, North Carolina is the best team in the country. I know it's odd to say when you look at what Wisconsin's done, Ohio State's playing very well, Arizona. But I think North Carolina is one of those teams, to beat Kentucky, but, you know, beat Louisville, you lose to Michigan State, you beat Michigan State, you lose to, you know, Belmont, but you knock off number 3 Louisville. They're just so Jekyll and Hyde. But you know, to those who follow the game closely or those who might, you know, just be kind of casual fans, I think this North Carolina team is very dangerous. I really like Nate Britt. He's one of those little guys. He's 5'11", buck 65, little skinny dude. And, Nate Britt has some of the best handles right now and one of the quickest guys on the floor. North Carolina to me is an exciting team to watch. Another thing I wanted to point out was Michigan State rebounding margin is +4 this year, guys. And I don't know, when's the last time you can remember a Nizzo team being only plus four on the board.
Right.
It's embarrassing.
Sure.
It's embarrassing.
Yeah. And that plus four is cumulative, right? I mean, you're just saying plus four for the whole season, right?
Correct.
Yeah, that's really stunning. That is pretty stunning.
Plus four, and I believe that's their game average. Plus four is their game.
Oh, I see. That's still not very good.
That's still not Izzo ball. I mean, you're looking I remember just last time I paid attention to the margin because it dropped ever so slightly. It was at like 11.3, and this was just a couple years ago. The Spartans are really missing Derek Nix. They don't have a top offensive rebounder other than Brandon Dawson, who's averaging 3.3 offensive rebounds per game, I believe. And it only takes 2.4 to make the top 10. Michigan State is number 5 in rebounding overall in the Big Ten, not number 5 in the country, number 5 in the Big Ten. And they're lacking a lot of that physical play that Derek Nix provided. I think Gary Harris is kind of you don't know if he rushed back from that ankle injury. He's not 100%. I don't know how much of Kenny Kaminsky we're going to see this year. It sounds like the kid just can't get it together academically. There's a lot of potential pitfalls, I think, right now for Michigan State that maybe we didn't see about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Now it's a team. Well, they have to stay together to win a national championship. Michigan State won't win a national championship if they can't rebound and Gary Harris can't stay healthy. That's the bottom line.
I would agree with that. Anna Biggers appears on the first and third Mondays of every month, and because this is a five-Monday month, we'll see Adam on the first part of January. So that means that we will not see him before the holidays. So I want to take this time to personally wish you and yours a very happy holiday and New Year, Adam.
Well, I appreciate it, Greg, and the same to you, Al. And I'm going to slip this in there for the viewers or the listeners. December 30th is my magical number 32 birthday. So if you're on Twitter and you want to follow me at AdamBiggers81, feel free to give me the solicited birthday shout-out on December
30th. do that, and also go to BleacherReport.com and just search Adam Biggers or just search Michigan football, and you'll find his stuff there as well. We will be happy to give you some ribbing over. He's still just such a baby, Al. 32 years old? My goodness gracious.
The years are flying by. Like Jameis Winston said at the Heisman ceremony, they said, you're incredibly poised or whatever for your age. Do you ever feel, sometimes you feel older? And he goes, yeah, sometimes I feel your age. I forgot who he said it to, but it was one of the ESPN commentators. So I thought that was pretty funny. But, I appreciate it, guys. Happy holidays to you and your family, Greg, and to you and your family, Al. And I look forward to joining you guys back in 2014.
Sounds great, my friend. Take care.
Thank you.
Good enough. Adam Biggers. Once again, just go to BleacherReport.com, search Adam Biggers, or just search Michigan football, and you'll see Adam's stuff come up there. And his Twitter handle, as he said, shamelessly said, is AdamBiggers81 is how you can follow him on Twitter. Al, before we start the discussion of all the topics, let's go to clue number two.
All right.
Whose birthday is it, and see if you can win that coveted hamburger helper. The first clue was I was a draft pick in the 1973 Major League Draft by the Baltimore Orioles. I ended up winning the 1979 AL Cy Young Award. I was a left-hander, and I did two different stints with the Orioles from 1975 to 87, and sandwiched in between there was a couple of years with the Toronto Blue Jays, and I teamed with Scott McGregor to form a really pretty potent 1-2 punch left-handed-wise for the Orioles. Who am I?
Yeah, this is one, now that I had a chance to think about it, it came to me because, and I think probably because we blocked it out, because it's just the end of his life really was so horrific, and that would be Mike Flanagan.
That would be Mike Flanagan. Mike Flanagan died, took his own life in 2011, had worked for the Orioles in a number of capacities. After his days as a player, he was head of baseball operations there for a couple of years. He was a broadcaster, and he was, I believe he pitched final. I'm not sure if he started the final game at Memorial Stadium or he finished it, one of the two. And that was by his request. He wanted to be part of that last game at Memorial Stadium before they moved to Camden Yards. Camden Yards, but yeah, Mike Flanagan would have been 62 years old today. Unfortunately, he, like I said, took his own life. The Hamburg Helper is on its way. Now, we've got lots of, even though the Lions did not play by the time this podcast is being recorded, there's still lots to talk about on the Detroit sports grid.
Yeah, definitely. Between what happened Sunday afternoon, a lot of craziness in the NFL when it comes to the Lions, and that all of a sudden, a couple weeks ago, Lions, you know, they still hold their own destiny, but what went down on Sunday, the Lions have gone from at one point looking like sure things to win a division to like, it's not looking good right now. Let's let's the Lions get their act together. So we'll talk about what happened there. Obviously, the Tigers made a good deal of news at the winter meetings. They made a big signing for left field. They found a platoon left fielder for Andy Dirks and Rajai Davis. There was a lot of rumors going around that Dave Dombrowski ended up shooting down. There was rumors around Matt Kemp, that the Tigers were going to put Max Scherzer back on a trading block. A lot of different oddball things going on. They did make another signing in that they signed Jabba Chamberlain, which did not go over very well with the fan base. Actually, most of this offseason has not gone over very well with the fan base, so we'll talk about that.
Right.
And, of course, we'll have to touch on Major League Baseball banning home plate collisions and the fallout. And some people think it's a great idea. There's, I think, a smaller majority that thinks it's dumb, we'll talk about as to why they're idiots. And, of course, we want to touch a little bit on the Wings. And, Greg, what is your Red Wings blog?
The Red Wings blog is the Winged Wheeler, and that can be found at thewingedwheeler.wordpress.com. It's kind of an amalgam of nostalgia and what's going on with today's Red Wings. You know, you'll see game recaps. You'll see news about personnel moves. You'll also see previews of that night's opponent, and you'll see that kind of stuff. But you'll also see some old stuff, some nostalgia, some stories of mine from my days of covering hockey, just following hockey, that I kind of pepper in there as well. So that's thewingedwheeler.wordpress.com. Please check that out. I would appreciate
that. And I would have to say that I think the nostalgic stuff is much more fun to write because the Wings still suck at home. So we'll talk a little bit about that as they lost back-to-back games over the weekend. They lost to the Penguins on Saturday, and they lost to the Lightning on Sunday. They're now, 5-9-6 at home or something ridiculous like that. So we'll touch on that. And we also wanted to touch on 30 years ago this past weekend, one of the wildest, craziest, most fun NBA games ever played, and it involved the Pistons, went down in the highest-scoring game in NBA history. The Pistons topped the Nuggets in two overtimes, 186-184, which is looking more and more like one of those records that's going to hold up for a long, long, long time, to say the very least. All right, let's start off, Greg. Let's touch on the NFL before we get on to some of the – we've got a lot of Tigers news. And obviously, by the time this podcast goes live, the Lions won't even have played yet. But lots of things happened on Sunday that really, if you're a Lions fan, you have to be disturbed by what went down.
Yeah.
The big one being how big was the – I think the Cowboys had a 23-26 point lead at one point in the second half and absolutely gagged it away. As I was telling our Packers fan friend, Kurt Menchie, who was a friend of the show, as he was hitting me up on Google Talk, that Jerry Jones right now, way that team is going in Dallas, he's like Nero as Rome burns because it's going all to hell in a handbasket in Dallas. Unfortunately, that Rome burning in Dallas has really affected the Lions because what should have been a loss for the Packers, Greg, is now they are still a half game behind the Lions. Also, for that matter, Cleveland didn't do the Lions any favors by really just stumbling and bumbling their way to a come from behind loss to the Bears. That loss was a 38-31, and you know there was some ridiculously bad play by the Browns, who at one point looked to have that game completely under control. All of a sudden, Greg, it's funny. Remember when everybody was talking that the Lions had a magic number of three and They were kind of starting to say, well, is this really a team that can make a run in the playoffs? And now with Monday night's game, which is not going to be an easy win at all, I mean, there's no guarantee that they can even beat the Ravens, who are pretty much a very similar team with the exact same record at 7-6. All of a sudden, yeah, the Lions do have their destiny in their own hands. The problem is, right now, I don't think they're capable of handling their own destiny, Greg. And I look and looking more and more like the Packers can, and so can the Bears.
You know, I think the word disturbing was very apropos, because that's exactly what those results of those games were on Sunday, the Dallas game and the Browns game. It's exactly what those were disturbing, because it just gives you a bad feeling that maybe the gods aren't with the Lions this year.
Yes.
Because maybe the Bears and maybe the Packers are getting their act together right at the right time, and it's kind of like a horse race where you're leading, and then all of a sudden you get passed by somebody who comes out, you know, down the outside, you know, like Secretary was famous for doing. And so it's just kind of nerve-wracking, to say the least, especially when Green Bay wins in such a ridiculous fashion. They were down 26-3 at halftime, no less, and their much maligned defense was looking every bit as it should have been, and looked like what it was looking like against the Lions on Thanksgiving Day, where they gave up 300 yards in the first half. And I, you know, you kind of flipped that game off a little bit and just kind of said, "Oh, the Packers are their goose is cooked." And lo and behold, they outscored the Cowboys 34-10 in the second quarter or second half, and it just completely puts the Packers back into the mix. They've got Aaron Rodgers probably will be back for the last two games. The Packers are very, very much alive in this division, and they could, frankly, very easily win it if they win their next two games and the Lions just drop one of the last three. And the Lions now are really, you talk about that magic number, you talk about the destiny in their own hands and everything, but really, they really almost have to win out to really, yeah, I mean, yes, they have their destiny in their own hands in the sense that if they win out, nobody can catch them. However, it's not, you just don't have that kind of feeling that they are going to win out because of the way they played lately and the way the other teams in the division are kind of, you know, surging a little bit. You're starting to get that really queasy feeling that maybe this is not going to happen this year and the Lions are going to somehow not win this division. Mm-hmm. And we should also note, by the way, that whoever does not win the division is not going to make the playoffs,
right,
more than likely, because there won't be a wild card spot for anybody out of the NFC North because of the other teams in the conference. So it's win the division or bust in terms of making the playoffs. And that's why this is such a big deal, because if you don't win the division, you're not going to make the playoffs. So it's that kind of a thing. The magic number that we keep talking about has remained stuck at three forever, it seems like.
And yep.
Continues to stay at three. And the Lions, of course, can knock that down a notch if they go. They can knock it down to two if they win on Monday night. But you know what, Al? This is kind of interesting, because I'm really eager to see. Even if the Bears had lost to Cleveland for whatever reason, the Lions still would have, I think, looked at the Ravens game as a must-win.
No,
they want to just keep losing, you know, and just keep trying to, you know, playing with fire. But I'm really eager now, trying to spin this positively, to see how they come out in really the first must-win game they've had in a long, long time, where they're really kind of been pushed to the brink of a disaster here, where if they don't win this game now, that all of a sudden the path to the playoffs, Al, gets really, really messy. Now they will need, if they do lose on Monday night, they will need help to get in the playoffs. They can no longer just win their next two games and be in, because if the Packers win their next two games, they're in.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have to kind of look at it in terms of, this is kind of a do-or-die game here Monday night. I'm really eager to see how the Lions come out and handle that, because we've been critical of their ability to do so, but just when you think that they may not, you know, have it in them, lo and behold, they come out with a performance that kind of stuns you as well. So I'm really eager to see how this whole team plays out.
Yeah, and you know what? Wouldn't that surprise you one bit if the Lions come out and just actually kick ass? Because
right.
They usually do seem to play very well, you know, on big event games, you know, even if we got to take Thanksgiving out of the equation. But they seem to have had some very successful outings on Monday Night Football, you know. So we'll have to wait and see. But at least hopefully they won't fumble seven times and some of the other ridiculousness that happened last week. But I think disturbing was the best word to say to really describe what went down this afternoon, because it was, if you're a Lions fan, it was just awful to see. You know, I mean, it made for entertaining football. I mean, NFL Red Zone Channel is the best thing ever invented, ever. And if you get to sit, and that's one best thing I think, Greg, about the Lions not playing and playing on Monday night, is that I was able to spend the afternoon. I was doing some other things. I was doing some writing for Bless You Boys and some stuff like that. But I had the Red Zone Channel on pretty much all damn day and got to see some hella entertaining football, even if it was painful to watch as a Lions fan. So, all right. Let's wrap this up and let's move on to Major League Baseball, because we got a lot to talk about when it came to Major League Baseball winter meeting in the Detroit Tigers. First off, Greg, they might as well talk about the big, big signing. I guess you can't call it big, big signing, but it's an important signing. We'll put it that way, because I think that the Tigers are, if they use Rajay Davis correctly, this guy could be a definite weapon for them and could really give them, with Andy Dierks, who we learned this past week, actually played with an injured knee all last season, which is why the Tigers are saying his offense really took a nosedive compared to his 2012. If he's healthy and Davis continues to perform as about as he has over the past few years, the Tigers have a very solid platoon in left field that could probably give them a very similar OPS to what Torrey Hunter gave them in right field last year. But Rajay Davis, he's a 33-year-old outfielder, inked a two-year deal, worth about $10 million, about $5 million a year. He's a part-time player for the majority of his eight-year career, but he's fast, and he rakes against left-handed pitching. That's the main thing. If you look at his overall stats, Greg, Davis doesn't look that impressive, 268, 316 on-base percentage. But when you look at his hitting against left-handed pitching, it's a whole new story opens up. He's a career 294 hitter with a 354 on-base percentage, and he slugs 425. He was even better last year with the Toronto Blue Jays, where he hit 319 against left-handed pitching. So this is one of these players, and let's not forget, he also stole 45 bases. When you factor all that in, he adds an element that this team really needs, speed. Nothing really special to talk about, but Andy Dierks was a Gold Glove candidate this past year, was actually nominated for it. So, and what he can do is, if he can help them against left-handed pitching, which the Tigers have struggled mightily against the last few years, this guy could really be a very, very, very good situational-type player. You know, get him 300 at-bats, 250 to 300 at-bats against pitchers he can handle. He's going to put up really good numbers, and he's going to steal a lot of bases, and he's going to help. Well, this offense needs something to trigger it. Davis can add that, because they're not going to have these three-run homers anymore. Not so much, other than from Miguel Cabrera, maybe occasionally from Victor Martinez. This is a team that's going to have to hit balls and gaps. This is a team that's going to have to take the extra base now, and that's Davis's game. So, Greg, what's your take on Davis, how he fits, and the new left field platoon?
You know, this platoon thing now is takes you back to the old days,
yes,
old school of baseball, where teams would shamelessly platoon. I remember Billy Martin especially when he managed the Tigers, was Mr. Platoon. I mean, he,
yes,
platooned everyone, almost,
mm-hmm,
he platooned almost half the position players, and they wanted a division in 1972 with that. Of course, part of that was because the team was older,
right,
and there weren't a lot of guys who could maybe have 500 or 600 at bats, but I remember the 1983 Orioles won the World Series with a platoon of John Lowenstein and Lee Lacy.
I think,
either left field or right field. I think it was Lee Lacy. Might have been Gary Renicky, but there was a definite platoon. I mean, a hard and fast platoon that Joe Altobello used then. So, you know, I think you're right when you say that the way that Rajay Davis is used is key. He's not going to be a 400 or 500 at bat guy. He shouldn't be, unless there's an injury situation. I think it's, you know, when you look at it, Al, the Tigers, I know a lot of people are kind of, you know, I'm not sure if they're wistful about,
mm-hmm,
the three-run homer or what. I mean, these are the same people that want a Prince Fielder run out of town.
Exactly.
It's just funny how you can't satisfy these people But the Tigers now, if you look at their the way they're being made up now, are I think more suited to that ballpark that they play in than they were before. I mean, they should be a gap to gap. You know, Austin Jackson. Let me go back even further. When Curtis Granderson was wrapping out 16 to 20 triples a year, he was using that field at Comerica Park. He was spraying the ball all over the place. He was using the gaps. Then he went to New York and it kind of turned him into this left-handed power hitter who struck out tons and who didn't go gap to gap. If you look at Curtis's numbers in terms of where his extra base hits were before he went to New York and after he went to New York, it just you can just see what that ballpark with that bandbox ballpark at New Yankee Stadium, what that did to Curtis in terms of his plate discipline and the type of hitter that he was. Now, Austin Jackson is showing a little bit of how he can kind of go gap to gap, and Davis is that kind of a guy. And yes, the three-run homer may not be necessarily the mode of choice in terms of this team scoring runs, but if you look at the Comerica Park and the way it's configured and what kinds of hitters that ballpark typically benefits. It's those guys who don't hit the three-run homers. The guys who hit the ball up the alleys and can leg out doubles and triples. And the thing I like about not only Davis, but Kinsler as well, and of course with the addition of Omar Vizquel coming on as a base running coach and what have you, is that maybe these guys, when I say these guys, the Tigers as a whole, start to run the bases a little bit smarter and a little bit better, and you'll start to see things like guys going from first to third on a single, first to home on a double, that kind of a thing. You know, those extra, like Brad Austin has spoken of already this offseason, taking that extra 90 feet, whether it's a pass ball or a wild pitch or any way you can get another 90 feet, Brad Austin seems to be the kind of guy that's all about doing that. And you mentioned Davis's stolen base numbers. It's not just the numbers of stolen bases, it's the percentage of which is impressive as well. And this is kind of for folks who are worried that he's going to be another Quinton Berry. He's not a Quinton Berry, believe me. First of all, he's a seasoned major leaguer. He's 33 years old. Secondly, he's a better, much better hitter than Quinton Berry will ever be. So he's not a one-dimensional, just a Herb Washington type of a guy who's just out there. You just throw him out there just to steal a base. He can, you know, he's not going to, like you said, he's not going to wow you with his defense, but you don't need that in left field anyway. I think that he adds a dimension that, if, like you said, if he's used properly, you don't over, which is really code for saying if you don't overuse him, then I think you'll be, he can team with Andy Dierks, if that's what Brad Osmus chooses to do, to form a left field tandem that collectively whose numbers could be kind of exciting.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and you're right. You make a great point in that for years that really seemed to be, especially in the 60s and 70s, that really was the trend in baseball is that platoons were a very standard, it was standard operating procedure. I mean, one of my all-time favorite Tigers, you know, he was only here for, like, I think 2 or 3 years, was Champ Summers. But he put up awesome numbers used in a right field platoon. The guy, you know, the guy hit 20 home runs and hit near 300 as long as he only faced right-handed pitching. So, you know, if you use guys like that in the right way, you know, they can be very, very effective. And Davis, you know, he said, don't give him 500 or 600 at-bats. You don't play him every day, but you play him enough and you may put him in positions to succeed, and 300 at-bats would be plenty to do that, where he can be a very effective player along with Andy Dierks. And it'll take some pressure off of Dierks as well, because I think he as well would be a much more effective player, Greg, if he is used a little bit less, and you give him only about 300 at-bats as well.
Well, especially if, you know, we don't know, you know, how he's going to respond to this knee injury that they're talking about, apparently about it all last year. You know, we're going to have to take everybody, I guess, on their word about that. I mean, you know, I guess what else can you do? But clearly he wasn't right,
that's for sure. He was not right.
Something bothered him because, you know, he just had such a tail off from his 2012 numbers. It wasn't even funny. So we don't know, you know, how this is going to impact Andy Dierks in terms of what this knee thing is going to do with him, if this is going to be something persistent or if he's over it by now or if he's going to go into 2014 healthy. We don't know. But all the more reason to, like you said, limit his at-bats. And he, we know, does not do well against left-handed pitching anyway. So this is not like you're really you're really not hurting yourself by limiting his bats against left-handers because he doesn't hit the left-handers very good anyway.
Right.
So now you've got Rajay Davis, who, like you said, is whose splits are very skewed toward left-handed pitching. Then again, of course, you don't see as many left-handers as you do in the course of the year as you do right-handers. That, so just by virtue of that, you would think that Andy Dierks would probably get maybe the 350 to 400 at bats where, you know, Davis would get 250 to 300 just
right.
by virtue of that. You just don't face left-handers as much as you face right-handers.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of left-handers, Al, in the AL Central.
Yes.
In the Tigers division that like you said earlier, have given the Tigers fits.
Mm-hmm.
So anything you can do to bring another right-handed guy, and I know he's not the big thumper that some people may have wanted. He's not a power guy from the right side, but anybody who can hit right-handed, can hit left-handed pitching, get on base, and create some havoc, and like Brad Ausmus says, and Brad Ausmus, you know, of course, speaking as a former catcher,
mm-hmm.
says, look, you know, you get a guy like Davis on base, and, you know, we don't know yet where he's going to hit in the order, but you get him on base, and you get pitchers start to think a little bit about what they're doing, and you maybe they're distracted, maybe they're paying too much attention to Davis, not enough attention to what's going on at the plate. That can only help. Brad Ausmus says, and he should know. He's a former catcher. Just got out of the game a couple of years ago as a player. He knows what a guy with speed can do to everyone. Everybody kind of clenches up a little bit, you know, even the outfielders, because now you've got a guy who can go from first to third, like I said, on a single. First, and even more importantly, Al, first to home on a double. How many times were they inefficient in getting to home plate from first base on a double? I don't know how many times we saw guys held up at third base or worse, getting thrown out of the plate because they just didn't have the wheels or the base running acumen to do that. And that first to home thing on a double is, if you just kind of pay attention to that for a week or so, you watch big league baseball games and watch how many times a guy scoring from first on a double either affects or doesn't affect the game because he either made it or didn't make it. You'd be amazed at how often that particular play comes into play, because those doubles, when a guy's on first base, when you can knock a guy in with a double with a guy in first base, that's a huge run. That is always a huge run, because now you don't have to rely on a sacrifice fly or another hit to get that guy home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of upside here. I think we can both agree with that. When I put it this way, I think this signing looks even better. And that is essentially that: would you rather a couple years of a Davis Dierks platoon, hopefully putting up pretty solid numbers, you know, maybe around 280, 290, you know, 15, 20 home runs, 70, 80 RBIs, and plus all those steals, or 7 or 8 years of Sin Shu Chu, who couldn't do that right now, but he sure as hell isn't going to be able to keep that up over the amount of
right.
that amount of time that contract's going to be.
Right.
And the rumors are Hughes wants money not much less than Jacob Lee Ellsbury got. So we're talking like $140 million. So I can understand why this makes so much more sense for the Tigers than throwing money at someone like Sin Shu Chu.
You know, I can already imagine in my head, and I hope this is true, hope this comes true, of Rajay Davis running around those base paths at Comerica Park, hitting a ball into the gap, and taking third base on a lot of hits that most players would only get a double on.
Yeah.
And I can see him doing that. You know, I like the fact that nobody's expecting him to hit home runs. He's just going to go out there and try to get on base a third of the time, and then try to take that extra 90 feet, like Brad Ausmus says. And, you know, I think it's, hey, the money wasn't, for the money that they paid, by the way, for his services, you know. But the thing I keep coming back to, and we talked about this a little last week, is the state of right field.
Mm-hmm.
Because Torrey Hunter is going to be, of course, gone more than likely after this coming season. He signed a 2-year contract. I don't see the Tigers extending that by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
And I'm frankly kind of concerned about Torrey, and just in terms of, you know, does he have another good year left in him? I think it was kind of a pleasant surprise.
No one saw
to me anyway.
A silver slugger year coming out of him when he.
No, I I know he was coming off a really good year with the Angels, and he did a great job batting second for the Angels when they put him there. But I was still pleasantly surprised at what he still had left in the tank, and now we're going to ask him to ask that yet again I know he's got this, you know, fervent desire to play in a World Series. And I get that. But, you know, sooner or later, your body just, you know, doesn't always follow what your mind or your heart wants to do. But right field, Al, even if they do get a good year out of Torrey Hunter in 2014, it's still going to be a bone of contention. They're still going to have to address right field real quick here because – and that is a position. That is a place where you need – typically you need a heavy-hitting – a power guy who, right field is a position you don't have usually a banjo hitter. You have a guy who can really be a middle of the order kind of a guy. And, you got to have a guy, of course, that's got a big arm, throw guys out. And, you know, right field is typically, you know, your strongest arm usually. I mean, center field and right field are both, obviously, both need that. But right field does, you know, you got that long throw from the corner toward third base. And, you know, so you got to have a really nice, combination of arm, power, average. If you're a championship contending ball club, you have to have that in right field. And I don't know where the Tigers are going to get that, certainly not internally, mm-hmm. unless they, again, go outside the organization. And I don't know off the top of my head, I don't know who the free agents are available yeah. next year. But they may have to go outside the organization to get that guy, because I don't know if there's anybody really coming up through the system unless and I could be wrong, because they may be in the lower minors right now. Mm-hmm. They'll be ready to take right field in 2015. But as far as Davis goes, I'm all on board with it, I hope that Andy Dierks does come back and does have more of the year he had in 2012. And I like him I like his short, compact swing. I like his defense. He doesn't have a great arm, but again, he's playing left field. They don't have to have that. And the fact that he was a candidate for a Gold Glove tells you that he has respected for his defense. And he could be a late inning defense replacement in games where Davis starts.
Yeah. And one other point to bring up before we move on to the next signing is that I think we're both in agreement that it's very likely Torrey Hunter is going to regress some this coming year. If the Tigers yeah. can get some increased production out of left field, that can cushion
right.
that. And that would go a long way towards, because we both know Torrey Hunter is not the defender he once was. And right now we're just hoping his bat can stay alive for one more year. So, but I think we're both in agreement. Left field looks solid, and it's going to be cheap, at least relatively cheap
yeah.
in today's
right.
market. All right,
right.
Let's move on to Joba. I've heard it, I know I slip into this sometimes. I want to call him Joba Chamberlain. But Joba Chamberlain, well, when it came to all the rumors that Dave Dombrowski, we'll touch on these in a little bit, shot down during the week of the winter meetings, one he didn't address was Chamberlain. And it turned out there was reason for that, because the Tigers, some interest showed up. There at least leaks came from the usual suspects, the Rosenthals of the world, that the Tigers were showing interest in Joba Chamberlain. A day later, they signed him to a one-year, $2.5 million contract with undisclosed performance bonuses. And actually, they gave the Tigers at least a bit of a discount, even though I'm sure those bonuses are going to make up for it, in that he had a $3 million offer on the table from the Arizona Diamondbacks. So Chamberlain's signing didn't go exactly very well with the fan base, because he really is coming off a couple of, mediocre seasons, is being generous. I think 2013, Chamberlain wasn't good at all. He had ERA pushing 5. I think he was around 4.93. But there's talent there. We've all seen it, because we saw he was the toast of New York in his first couple years when he had he was sort of the Joel Zumaya of the Yankees for a couple years, especially his rookie season. You know, he had a huge strikeout rate at that time. But he's had Tommy John surgery. I believe he broke an ankle. He's had some injuries that really kind of derailed his career. And plus, bouts of ineffectiveness, he's had trouble with walks. So if Jeff Jones, the Tigers pitching coach, has one job to do in spring training, this is it: fix Joba Chamberlain. Because the talent is there for this guy to fill a good role with the Tigers. He could step in and be your seventh inning guy, no problem. He's got the stuff if they can harness it and figure out why he hadn't pitched well in a couple of years. But it was also interesting during a press conference for the introduction is that a lot of people were asking, well, why not just keep Jose Veras, because he was only $4 million. You're not really saving that much money. And it was very interesting when Dave Dombrowski essentially said they think they got a better pitcher, saying that I think they really soured on Jose Veras at the end of the year because he really was being used in September not as an all-around kind of guy who can get lefties and righties out. He was being used as a right-handed specialist, and he wasn't very good at that. And obviously, we know what happened in the playoffs. But I think Greg Chamberlain, this is the kind of guy that you need to get in your bullpen, in that if he pitches well, he's got a lot of upside, and he can really make a huge difference. He's not going to do it for a whole lot of money. That's what you need in your bullpens. You need to take some flyers on guys who can, you know, surprise you. I mean, look at Al Albuquerque. He was known to have great stuff, but he couldn't harness it, and he bounced around from organization to organization to organization until the Tigers were able to harness that and actually get some production out of him. So if the Tigers can do the same thing with Chamberlain, this would be a great signing. I think he's worth taking a flyer on. I was hoping they could get him a little cheaper, but for $2.5 million, it's not bad for a guy who could give you 60 good innings.
Well, you know what's interesting about the contract, Al, is that it was only 1 year. And, mm-hmm. A guy like that hits free agency, who's as young as he is. He's only 20 years old.
Right.
When he is only able to get a 1 year commitment from another big league team, yep. And he's only able to get that commitment for $2.5 million. Now we should mention and add that contract also has performance incentives in it.
Yes.
So I don't know what those are. I don't know what those are, but it's 2.5 base. He could make more money if he – I'm not sure what the incentives are, but there are incentives in that contract.
But they're probably enough to at least get him over that $3 million hump that was the other contract offer. So
significant. I don't know if it's – and for those who are maybe a little cynical, I have no idea if it has anything to do with his weight. I have no idea. But it's interesting that a guy that age – and it was funny, we were talking about Tommy John surgery last week, and it seems like the list of people who have not had Tommy John surgery is becoming smaller and smaller. And here's another one who's had Tommy John surgery. But, you know, the thing about Chamberlain, Al, and you can look at this two different ways. He pitched in New York, and we've already talked about how that ballpark is not pitcher-friendly, at least not in terms of home runs.
Right.
Now, Chamberlain – and this is not something that's going to make Tigers fans feel all that warm and fuzzy, by the way. In the last couple of years, he's been very prone to giving up home runs.
Yes.
His home run to innings pitched ratio is not very good. However, in 15 career innings, I believe, at Comerica Park, he's given up none. Now, I know that's a small sample size, but he did pitch a lot of innings, obviously, in New York. So you have to kind of take those home run numbers maybe with a little grain of salt. However, it's not going to ingratiate him to the faithful here if he starts throwing up long balls in late inning situations.
Right.
So that's got to stop. Somehow that's got to get better. But what's funny, Al, about bullpens is that they're kind of like NFL secondaries. They can have really good years 1 year and then not so good years the next year.
Right.
A lot of baseball teams will have a really magical year with their bullpen. Remember the Texas Rangers a few years ago when the Rangers were going to back-to-back World Series? They did that largely on the back of their bullpen. I mean, the bullpen was outstanding from the sixth inning on, and they really had a lot of shutdown guys. And then the bullpen then started out the last couple of years to kind of crumble a little bit out there. And so you have these bullpens that seem to be set on paper. I had this discussion with somebody on Facebook recently about he was pointing out these teams that supposedly have their bullpens all set. And I said, I countered with, well, you know, who ever has a bullpen that's set anymore? I mean, it might be set in the sense that they've got all their guys slotted into where they need to go in spring training. Nobody's really battling for a position, and they're just going there just to kind of have spring training and get through it, and then everybody's going to be starting the regular season in their slotted positions. But it does not mean that they're going to perform the exact same way this year as they've done in years past. Bullpens are very shaky and very tenuous.
Yes.
And, like you said about Albuquerque and guys like that, you can catch lightning in the bottle or a guy can finally put it together who has not done so, whether it's within your organization or within somebody else's organization, and have that year where you can get those 60 to 70 reliable innings. And so, you know, short guys like Nathan, who have done it year after year, and guys like Mariano Rivera, who's a Hall of Fame closer, a lot of relievers now. Look at what happened with Jason Grilley.
Mm-hmm.
Jason Grilley was not anything to write home about. He had a nice career. It was a nice, decent career. Then all of a sudden, he really put it together this year with the Pirates. Unfortunately, he got hurt, but he really put it together. He was in an All-Star game, I believe. He was lights out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that just wasn't happening at his other stops. So, you know, and he was like, what, Jason's like 35, 36 years old. Mm-hmm. So there's times where you can get a guy in the right situation, or maybe he just has that 1 year, and, you know, so with Chamberlain, obviously, you mentioned Jeff Jones, and that's good that you mentioned that, because it is going to be up to Jeff Jones to try to get Jabba figured out, because he's, you know, like it or not, whether he's only $2.5 million or not,
mm-hmm.
he is going to, he's expected to fill a very important role with this Tigers bullpen. If he does not do well, Al,
mm-hmm.
That's not going to be good for – now, Drew Smiley's out of the bullpen. Drew Smiley's in the rotation now. You know, you've got Albuquerque still, I think, makes people a little bit nervous at times. Nathan, we presume, will be solid. Rondon is a question mark. Well, can he handle the eighth inning or whatever role he's going to be given? So the Chamberlain thing, at least he's a guy who he's kind of a younger veteran. He's 28. Maybe he's gotten past this bad patch. Maybe he needed to get out of New York, both mentally and as far as the ballpark. And we should also mention, too, that he does have a little bit of a history of being a little bit goofy mm-hmm. off the field. And maybe that's part of the maturing process and the fact that maybe, you know, sometimes when you play in New York, you kind of does funny things to your head. He's coming to an organization now that obviously still has very high expectations, but is not anywhere near the circus that you have in the Bronx.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's that may be even one of those, you know, change of scenery things that might help guys. And you make a good point. Just get him the hell out of New York at this point, because yeah. it was never going to work for him after the disappointments and things that he's been through, and obviously the last couple of pretty lousy years. I hope the Tigers aren't done. I mean, I would like to see them pick up a couple more bullpen arms. But, that kind of leads us to the next topic, and that is Dave Dombrowski, Tigers GM, made the media rounds during the winter meetings and denied some rumors. He said there was a hot rumor one day that the Tigers were in talks with the Dodgers on Matt Kemp. He said, there's been no discussions. There was a really hot rumor saying, well, there's contradictory rumors. The first one that came out was that the team didn't think they were going to be able to extend Max Scherzer. And so that's what they were supposedly telling teams, and they were obviously open to trading Max Scherzer. And then there was a contradictory one saying, well, they're not going to trade him anyway. And it was obviously Dombrowski just shot it all down, saying the team hasn't even begun the extension process with Matt Scherzer, had not even talked to agent Scott Boras about it. And the most interesting thing, I think, which I think kind of upset fans, so to speak, is that Dave Dombrowski reiterated the Tigers are happy with their roster at the moment. Now, he said he was asked both about position players and the bullpen, because obviously the rotation is set. And he said he does not anticipate pursuing anyone at this point. He pretty much said the Chamberlain signing was the last move he anticipated the Tigers making, which of course, you know, puts people they got to do better than this. But well, all this taken into account, Greg, do you see the I personally don't think the Tigers are going to make another big move, because I think they have reached the limits of their payroll. They're going to be over $150 million. I don't think they can go much higher than that, and I think that has had something to do with some of the moves we've seen. So that means they aren't going to trade for Matt Kemp. They aren't going to sign Sin Shu Choo. They're not going to make another splashy signing. And I think that at this point, I think the roster we see right now is what we're going to see probably really close to it on opening day. Unless, as Dave Dombrowski said, something falls into his lap. You never know what the phone call is going to bring. But let me ask you, are you happy with the roster as is right now, Greg? Or would you like to see them do more? Or do you believe, as I do, is that I think money is being an issue at this point?
You know, it's funny about that, because, you know, you like to – I mean, it's easy to think that money has something to do with this, but
mm-hmm. –
But on the other hand, if you look at it from a pure baseball sense, I think you can make a good argument for a lot of the moves that Dave Dombrowski has made from a pure baseball sense, taking the money out of the equation. Now, having
mm-hmm.
said that, I would also feel a little bit better if they had one more guy in that bullpen.
Yes.
Got, some traction on his tires. Because, you know, I'm a firm believer that you just cannot have too much experience in your bullpen, especially when it comes to a team that's trying to win a World Series.
Yeah.
And you know, I keep talking about, and people are probably tired of me talking about Octavio Dotel, but he was the kind of guy that was supposed to fill that role
mm-hmm.
last year. Obviously, he got hurt, and it didn't materialize. And they tried to, and you know, if you look at last year's bullpen, Al, at this time, they were counting on Bruce Rondon to be the closer. They were thinking Joaquin Benoit was going to continue to be the eighth-inning guy, and Jose Valverde was out of their plans. And then not a month into the season, Jose Valverde was back to being the closer.
Right.
Rondon was in the minor leagues. Benoit was still doing his thing, but then shortly after that, Benoit became the closer. So really, last year's bullpen situation was probably a lot worse going into the season because the Rondon, putting all that pressure on Rondon to be the closer. At least now they've got an established closer. Well, if you've got an established closer, that's a great start. But I would still feel better if they, and this could still happen, by the way, anytime between now and spring training or even during spring training, where Dombrowski could pick up an arm, you know, a weathered arm, the guy that's been around the block a little bit, you know, even, you know, yeah, I don't care how old he is. A guy who's pitched in big games before, kind of be a calming influence, you know, they could kind of move around the bullpen in the sense that he could be a sixth-inning guy, eighth-inning guy, whatever you need him to be that particular night. That kind of a guy who's maybe got some traction, maybe he's north of 35 years old, somebody like that. I would love if they brought somebody like that in. But, you know, from a position player standpoint, they seem to be content with Brian Holliday to be the backup catcher. They seem to be content with letting Ramon Santiago go and having Lombardozzi being their utility guy in the infield. They brought back, of course, Don Kelly. They've got, you know, obviously a new second baseman and you know, Castellanos at third base. And I think the Castellanos at third base thing might be a little bit, make people a little bit uneasy, but, you know, what else are you going to do at this point? You know, if this kid is as good as everybody keeps saying he is, and then it's time now. It's time to find out if they're indeed going to not trade him and not use him as a bargaining chip,
mm-hmm.
then you got to play him.
I mean, yep.
It's time for him to play now. You can't just keep, pushing him off. It's time now. If they're not going to trade him, if he's not going to be packaged with for in a trade, then you got to play him. And frankly, with Prince Fielder gone and Miggy Cabrera moving to first base, then it makes sense to play Nick at his natural position. He's been taking,
mm-hmm.
he said, like five or six or 700 ground balls a day. He's going to be working with Omar Vizquel, ahead of spring training. Before they even get to Florida, to kind of regain that mojo at third base and to get even better at third base than he was before. But, you know, I mean, I don't know if there's really anything out there. I mean, what's got to happen is that it's not just going out and getting guys. It's guys that are on the roster have to play better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, Austin Jackson's got to play better. Alex Avila's got to hit better. These guys have got to – certain guy Dierks, we talked about Dierks. Certain guy Hunter, we don't know. Certain guys that are on the roster right now are going to have to kind of step it up a little bit. Because, A, I don't think there's any more moves coming.
Mm-hmm.
And, B, they've shown that they can do it in the past. Well, they've got to do it again. Because a lot of what was ailing this club, and it seemed to, unfortunately, rear its head in the playoffs, was those guys just didn't perform.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that Alex Avila's been banged up, and I know we talked about him before and how that's physically a grind for him and everything, and how he may not even be a catcher in a couple of years. But the bottom line is he's a starting catcher. I mean, Brian Holliday's not going to get more than 100, provided Alex is healthy, Holliday's not going to get more than 125 at bats. So Alex has got to be, he can't hit 220 again. He can't hit under 200 into August like he did last year.
Yeah.
He can't do it. And I don't care what the excuse is. I don't care what physical things he's battling. You cannot have your starting catcher for a World Series contending team
mm-hmm.
hitting below 200 in August. And that's exactly what Alex was doing until he stepped it up a little bit and got his average, I think, to like 220 or something. But, I mean, you know, that kind of stuff just can't happen anymore. Austin Jackson, and we don't, again, mm-hmm. we don't know what Brad Auspice's lineup is going to be like, whether Austin's going to hit up top or toward the bottom, but Austin Jackson's got to get it together a little bit, too. I mean, guys that are on the, it's not, you can't just go out and just trade your way out of trouble.
Right.
Sooner or later, you got to rely on the players who are on the roster who have shown in the past that they can do it. They've got to do it because you just can't reel and deal your way totally to World Series. You got to rely on the guys who are already on the team.
Yeah, and I think what's most still concerning is the Tigers are looking for bounce back seasons out of guys in the bullpen. Just in that,
right.
There's a lot of question marks there. Obviously, one is Joe Nathan. There's age.
He's
got a Tommy John in his past with Bruce Rondon. He couldn't finish out the year last year because of an elbow issue. So there's health issues with him. And then obviously Chamberlain. We just talked about the issues with him. I think they're still depending on Al Albuquerque. And we know he's, the last couple of years, he's been a coin flip. He's either awesome or he can't throw a strike and he wild pitches guys all over the place. So the bullpen... usually you're going to have a couple of question marks in the bullpen. Right now, other than Nathan, the entire bullpen is one large question mark, and I think that's what's got people kind of worked up. And especially when you factor in Drew Smyly to the rotation means the bullpen's going to probably have to step up their game because I think it's very safe to assume Drew Smyly is not going to throw 200 innings. He's never thrown more than 120 in his career at this point. So there's going to be probably about 40 innings or so, give or take. Say he can get up to 160, that the bullpen is going to have to cover. So there's I'll just say this, Greg. I don't think any of us expected an offseason quite like this, especially for a team that is coming off three straight division titles, was a couple wins away from making a World Series again. And this entire team has really been reimagined from a plodding, dependent on power team to one that I hate to use the term manufactured runs because I'm not a fan of bunting and small ball and things like that.
But this
team needs, like you said, guys like Alex Avila, Austin Jackson, and Nick Castellanos. They need those guys a little bit lower in order to produce closer to their career norms. If they can do that, they can probably, I think they can cover for a lot of the offense they've lost. But still, it's one large question mark over it right now, and I never would have said that 2 or 3 months ago.
Well, you know what? You're going to get some analysts when the preview magazines hit the bookshelves or magazine racks in mid to January when all those Street Smiths and all those kind of magazines hit. You're gonna start to see some people are gonna be contrarians out there. They're gonna pick the Indians. They're gonna pick the Royals.
Yeah.
They're gonna go against the grain because they might think the Tigers have not improved, and they may think that all those other teams have. I don't think, frankly, that the Indians have all improved all that much. I know the Royals are
right now. They still don't have anything.
And then the Royals, who do have pitching, still don't have much of an offense. And although they did have some bounce back years from guys like Hosmer and Moustakas, they still need offense. I know it looks like they're going to sign Omar Infante to 4 years. It looks like that's what the rumor is. Anyway, that'll help them a little bit. But there's going to be a lot of people who are going to look at the Tigers and they're going to see them become this hybrid now. They're more of a hybrid team. They're not clearly not a thumping those plotting guys that you talked about. But nor are they a National League team who are totally relying on speed and gap to gap. They're kind of a hybrid right now.
Mm-hmm.
So teams are going to look at and the fact that they've got a first year manager and there's a question mark about who's going to bat lead out. There are a lot of question marks for a team that's, like you said, came very close to going to the World Series. Frankly, you mentioned a couple wins away.
Mm-hmm.
Might have been just one injury away, and you know who I'm talking about. But you know, they're going to look at this team and say, well, you know, there's no – I've not seen the same kind of, dangerous offense that I've seen. Well, that's depending on what kind of offense you're talking about. There's different ways to score runs. There's different ways to put pressure on other teams. And I look at the Tigers now, Al, it's kind of being more of like a, of a what the Angels used to be, and when they were mm-hmm. really good. You know, they were a kind of a hybrid of power and speed and defense, and Mike Scioscia, who was a very aggressive manager, put a lot of pressure on the other team by doing a lot of hitting and running and just pure base stealing. And now here's the thing, at least Brad Ausmus, as a first-year manager and as a younger guy, is going to have, if nothing else, if this roster has, if this makeover, if you want to call it that, has done nothing else, at least gives him as a first-year manager some options of things to do.
Mm-hmm.
He's got some more buttons to push. Let's face it, he's got some more buttons to push than Jim Leland ever did. And Jim was here for you know, what, 7 years and never had the kind of speed, number one, that the Tigers have right now, number one, and potentially as good of a defense, infield defense, as you know, if Castellanos can handle third base, this infield defense could be pretty good, too. Jim Leland didn't have the kind of buttons to push that Brad Ausmus is going to have in terms of hitting and running and pure base stealing and leading replacements and that kind of thing. But it's all, I think, it's still going to come down to the bullpen. And that's still going to be, I think, where the Tigers are going to either sink or swim is how those guys perform. You know, Albuquerque, you mentioned it. I mean, I just hate to have a guy in a bullpen where you literally don't know what you're going to get from night in and night out. And if he doesn't show more consistency, because every time he comes in the game, you just don't know what you're going to get. And you can't have guys coming into the bullpen, Al. I look at other teams in the Tigers division even. Forget the rest of the league. But just within the AL Central, I thought the Tigers' bullpen was maybe worse than everybody's except Chicago's. Mm. In that division.
Right.
I mean, even Minnesota had a pretty good bullpen. I just looked at the arms that were coming out of those bullpens whenever the Tigers would play those teams, and it seems like they had way better arms coming out from the pen than the Tigers did, at least in terms of reliability. Now, granted, I don't follow those teams every day like I follow – I don't see those teams every day like I see the Tigers. But it just seems to me that the other teams were trotting out these guys from the pen that were these younger, dynamic arms that were really – performing well. Where the Tigers were
mm-hmm.
winning the division was they were just beating teams into submission with their offense and their starting pitching. Obviously, clearly the Tigers are the best starting pitching in the division. But when it came to those, that's why the Tigers, Al, performed so badly in extra inning games.
Yeah.
They did not have that dynamic of going from first to third on a single, taking that extra 90 feet, going from first to home on a double. They didn't have that, and that's why they lost a lot of games. I think their record in extra innings is like 5-14 or something, and that's one of the reasons why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a man. It's going to be a very interesting spring around here, to say the very least. And I'm going to be very eager to see how this team starts to gel, because there's and when I keep throwing question marks out there, there's a huge question mark around Brad Ausmus. We have no idea how he's going to manage or how good he is, how he's going to manage a clubhouse. So. We'll just have to wait and see, but I have a feeling that we're going to head into a dead period pretty soon with the Tigers, and we'll probably be scrambling for news for about the next 6 weeks or so because of Christmas, and then unless something big happens, and right now it's not looking like it, the Tigers are pretty much done making moves. All right, before we hit the home stretch with the Red Wings and Pistons, we've got to touch on home plate collisions, Greg. This past week at the winter meetings, managers and GMs voted to abolish home plate collisions. If the Major League Baseball Players Association approves, the new rule will go into effect immediately in 2014. If not, the rule will be just put into effect unilaterally in 2015, union be damned. It was interesting in that this past weekend, there was a meeting, a presentation given to team trainers and medical officials who were told that 22% of all concussions in baseball are caused by collisions, and obviously the vast majority of those collisions happen at home plate. So obviously this is more of one of those, I think, baseball scenes what's happening in football when it comes to head injuries. I think they're trying to kind of nip it in the bud, so to speak, some of the issues when it comes to head injuries, and this is the way to do it. Obviously, catchers are going to be the most susceptible to this sort of thing. So, and we've seen what happened to Buster Posey a few years ago. I mean, you can go back to what happened to Ray Fosse in the 1970 All-Star Game. Careers are at risk. There's a lot of money on the line of players because, good catchers are worth a lot of money, and they're hard to find. So when you factor in the injury issue, you factor in the liability issue, you factor in, you know, you want to keep players healthy because you're paying them big money issue, and you want to factor in the entertainment issue. I can see why Major League Baseball is doing this, Greg. But again, umpires are going to have to be very uniform in how they put the rule into effect, because catchers cannot be brick walls in front of the plate anymore. They're going to have to be much more like players on the bases, where they can – they're going to have to make sweep tags. They're just going to have to maybe just kind of keep – just stay off to the side a little bit. So, and if they do block the plate, umpires got to call it. They got to call interference, because that's what the rules are going to be now. We can't have huge collisions at the plate anymore. So it's going to be tough to fully eliminate them, because they're going to happen. You know they're going to happen. You know, for like on wild pitches, you know, I'm surprised I haven't seen more injuries when pitchers come racing to the plate of a runner.
Right.
But I really think that it's a good idea. But some fans, Greg, are up in arms over what they consider the wussification of the game. I think forgetting that there are lives at risk here.
You know, I have no problems at all with baseball, with MLB trying to, you know, legislate collisions out of the game. I really don't. I mean, first of all, I think that you can – I don't think it really takes – I don't think it hamstrings the catchers in terms of making plays at the plate. I think you mentioned sweep tags. You know, there's other ways you can defend the plate and, and tag a runner out, and it still all comes down to the throw. If the throw out is good and is on time, or is ahead of the runner, you're going to get your out. You're going to get your out.
Right.
You know, you don't have to be blocking the plate. You don't have to be standing in front of there and impeding the base runner. And for the base runner's part, he does not have to. You know, he can do things like hook slides, and there's other ways to get to the plate, frankly. You don't have to have collisions. When you're looking at it from both perspectives, you don't have to block the plate, and you don't have to bowl people over to get to the plate. And so I have no problem. I never really found all that much excitement out of a home plate collision. I never did. I never thought that was like one of the must-see things, like a penalty shot hockey, or some of the other dynamic things you can see in sports. I never considered a home plate collision as something that was really floating my boat anyway. I mean, I really didn't. So I'm not going to miss them if they don't ever happen again. I agree with you that they're not going to be totally legislated out, because A, it's a new rule, and you have to. With any new rule, there's going to be, especially with any new rule that is subject to the umpire's discretion, there's going to be, some controversy. Now, they can go to video review, apparently, in some instances, and try to determine matters that way. But, so there's going to be, like you said, there's going to still be collisions, at least initially, just as teams try to get used to this whole thing. But, it should cause catchers to be taught in spring training and hopefully beyond, hopefully much below, way below big league baseball level, starting in high school and moving on up, different ways for catchers to position themselves to make plays at the plate, to receive throws and make tags without having to put their body in front of them right in the baseline. And when you think about it, there's no other base. Al, there's no other base where you can do that.
Right.
Anyway, you can't do that at first base. You can't do that at second base. You can't do that at third base. So why can you do it at home plate? I don't know why, but for whatever reason, it's been that way. I laud this decision. I think it's good for all. I think it's good for all parties involved. It's not just catchers that can get hurt, by the way, in these collisions. The base runner can get hurt as well. I mean, it's not just the catchers. So this isn't. I don't want people to look at this as just strictly a wussification. I hate that word, but a wussification of the catching position. This is designed to save injuries on both sides, the base runner and the catcher. Because, frankly, the catcher, at least the catcher's got some gear on. He's got shin pads.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a chest protector. He's got, the base runner doesn't have any of that. So there's advantages and disadvantages to being on the receiving end of these collisions and being on the giving end of these collisions. I have no problem with baseball saying, enough is enough. Because, like you said, this whole concussion thing, and it's, we've talked a lot about it with football, but it's everywhere. It's in hockey. It's in baseball. It's in football. It's in basketball. Everywhere now, concussions are becoming a problem.
Yeah.
And whatever you can do to, you know, you mentioned Buster Posey. Of course, that wasn't a concussion thing. That was just his leg getting
made. Yeah, and a gruesome leg injury. That?
Yeah, oh, yeah. And whatever you can do to eliminate or reduce that, I don't know why you would be against that. I don't know why you would be against anything that keeps players that you pay to see, that you complain about making all this money, on the field.
Yeah.
I don't know why you would complain about anything that's designed to keep players in uniform playing.
Yeah.
Because that's, I don't know. I just don't know why you would do that. And I'm all for it. I'm all for it. Now, to give people more background about this, if they don't get the player union's approval before this upcoming year, then it won't be instituted until they can do it unilaterally, I guess, in 2015.
And that's the plan.
So we don't know whether or not it's going to show up this year or not. But
I don't see why you would go against it at all. So
I don't either. I don't either. You know, and this is something that could lengthen careers or certainly prevent the shortening of careers.
Yeah. And one thing to keep in mind as well is baseball does now have their first officially diagnosed ball player who had brain damage. And that was Ryan Friel, who committed suicide a year ago. And this past weekend, it was confirmed, you know, from autopsies and studies that Friel was suffering from stage 2 CTE when he committed suicide. And it's confirmed or reported that he suffered 9 or 10 concussions during his career. That he was a utility guy. He just threw his body around and would run into walls and things like that. And he, you know, he is pretty much wore out after 8 years, and it was confirmed the guy had brain damage. So this is what this is. The baseball is laying the groundwork to start pretty much doing the same thing the NFL has done and starting to legislate, try as best they can, I guess I could say, to try to legislate concussions out of the game. You know, it's impossible to do, but you can minimize the risk, and that's what baseball is doing right now. All right, Greg, we got to talk about the Red Wings because it's painful right now. They continue to struggle at home, and I know you've been following them closer than I have because I've been tied up with the winter meetings, but obviously you have the Winged Wheeler now, so you've been writing about them. And this past weekend, has been very, very sad for the Red Wings and their fans. A sorry 4-1 loss to the Penguins on Saturday. Then there was, I think, maybe even a worse loss to the Lightning on Sunday, the 3-0. The Wings are now 5-12-9 overall. That's okay. But when you look at their beyond ridiculous home record, it's now 5-9-6. I guess right now, Greg, the only explanation I have for their play, you know, even though it doesn't mesh with why they're doing okay on the road, is that right now the Wings are devastated by injury. One of my Twitter friends, the Production Line blog, they just tweeted, for Tuesday night's game, the Red Wings are going to be short 7 players: DeKeyser, Helm, Zetterberg, Weiss, Howard, Ablicator, and Franzen. So there's some issues here. I'm not sure it's all performance oriented. There are some serious injury issues with this team right now, but you still would expect them to play better at home.
Well, there's a lot of Grand Rapids Griffins on this team right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's. And that speaks to what you were just talking about, the injuries.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I will give you that the team is banged up. There's no question about it. Jimmy Howard's out for, you know, and you can say all you want about Jimmy Howard not getting off to a great start this year, but he's still the number one goalie. He's out for about a month. You've got Darren Helm again out. You've got, of course, Zetterberg and Datsyuk. Datsyuk's back now, but he was out for a while. Zetterberg is still out and will continue to be out probably until after the first of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Danny DeKeyser, of course, is out. Justin Ablicator had a horrific hit horrifically Saturday night against Pittsburgh. There's a lot of Griffins up there right now. They started Peter Mrazek in goal on Sunday. Even Jonas Gustafsson was tweaked his groin a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's okay, but you know, yeah, you're right. I mean, there's no question. There are guys playing right now. They just brought up Thomas Yurko. There's a lot of guys that are playing right now that probably shouldn't be playing the NHL right now. That doesn't mean they're not good players. It doesn't mean they're not going to be good NHL players. But right now, that's the case. Now, prior though, Hal, prior to all these injuries, the team was still not really playing all that well. And you mentioned the home thing; they can't score.
Yeah,
this is one of the worst, lowest scoring Red Wings teams we've seen in a long time. Of course, the Red Wings were for years, and at least since the 21st century began, were and even going before that, were one of the higher, always one of the higher scoring teams in the NHL. Certainly in the top five, sometimes in the top ten, but certainly in the top ten. And they were always scoring three and a half goals a game.
Mm-hmm.
All that puck possession and, you know, what the firepower they had, whatever. Well, obviously this is not your father's Red Wings right now. This is a team that even when healthy struggles to score. I mean, you know, you put all those guys back in the lineup. Put Helm back in. Put Zetterberg back in. Put DeKeyser back in. Anybody else you can think of back in there. You know, they're still offensively challenged, and because they've, you know, just slowly but surely, out kind of almost like in a drip way, they've lost guys that they have not been able to re-sign. Val Filppula, who is playing very well for the Lightning, for example, was somebody they did not want to see go. But in this day and age of salary cap, you can't keep everybody. So Val left. Yuri Hudler, he wouldn't have minded to have come back, even though he had a little bit of a rough patch there for a while. But, you know, Hudler's, I think, leading the Flames in scoring. So there's, they've lost some guys, just those two guys right there. And then you factor in the lack of production from Steven Weiss, who's another injured guy, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's just all really starting to catch up with them. And, you know, this is maybe the most, stress that the Red Wings as an organization have faced in a long time in terms of getting through this. You mentioned their record, overall record. They're still in the hunt for sure to make the playoffs, but you get the feeling that record's going to start to get a little bit worse before it gets better because of the injuries, and they're just playing a lot of guys out that just have not played with each other very much, except for in training camp, and it's just not. And then guys whose resumes are not showing up. Dan Cleary, Michael Samuelson, players that they thought they were going to be, 15 to 20 goal guys, because they've done in the past. And then you had guys like Franzen, who's very streaky. He can get very hot and he can go very cold. They don't have a sniper, a guy that they can go out there and score 30 goals in his sleep. They just don't have that. And so what they need to do is they need to have everybody on board, and unfortunately, it's not happening. They scored one goal over the weekend. They were outscored 7-1 at home in those two games you mentioned, and just not playing with a lot of confidence. And it's such a confidence-driven game, hockey is, boy, I tell you, you start to feel like you could snake big. You grip the stick tighter. Everybody knows about the problems at home. Nobody has to tell them about it, but you got to know that it's on their minds. Because let's face it, look at the splits. Look at how good the record is on the road.
Yeah,
it's they're 10-3-3 on the road. And they're 5-8-6, I believe. They're 15-11 overall. 5-8-6 at home, which essentially means that they've won 5 out of 19 home games. They've played 19 home games already, and they've only won 5 of them.
Yeah.
And that is really says a lot right there. And if they would have just won a few more of those home games, they'd be firmly entrenched in the playoffs. But because they can't win at home, it's really, and because their first half of the schedule was home heavy, it's really hurting them.
Yeah, and this should shake itself out, because some of this is just, best way to put it, bad luck. I hate to use the term bad luck, but sometimes it's just bad luck, especially when you lose shootouts. This team has plenty of talented guys on this team who can win shootouts, but for some reason right now, the Wings can't buy shootout goals. For that matter, they can't buy a damn power play goal at this point. So, it's still early in the season. Things do need to shake out a little bit. I'm not overly concerned yet, but I'd call it very annoying, to say the very least, that they're playing so badly at home right now. But before we move on, we should touch on the Ablicator injury, because it was one of those unnecessary hits that leads to severe head injuries. In this case, Derek Englund just absolutely smoked Abdicator in the head of his shoulder. You know, one of those mid-ice, he didn't need to hit him the way he did. He still lowered, got his shoulder right in the jaw, square hit, leveled him. You know, they pretty much had to, they had to carry him, not carry him, but they had to help him off the ice. It was obvious. Abdicator didn't know where he's at. Right now, the Wings don't know when he's going to return. England was given a match penalty when he took out Englander, took out Abdicator, but this has got to have a suspension, Greg. It was a brutal, dirty, unnecessary hit, and it's exactly the kind of hit that the NHL is legislating out of the game. I mean, it looks great when a guy gets blown up, but you can't blow up a guy in the head like that. It's just unacceptable at this point, and I hope they level, and I hope Brendan Shanahan does his job and lowers a pretty darn good suspension on England right there for that.
Well, he probably will. I mean, I'm sure he will, but the thing about the hit, too, Al, is that the Red Wings did not make the Penguins pay for that. There was a 5-minute penalty that the Red Wings had a 5-minute pause.
Yep, and didn't score.
Not only did they not score, they didn't really come close to scoring.
Yeah.
And that was against the backup goalie. Marc-Andre Fleury did not play, and Marc-Andre Fleury's having a great year. It was interesting. I thought it was very interesting, by the way, that the Penguins, although they did play the night before, that they chose to sit Fleury against the Red Wings. You would never have seen that in the past.
Right.
Teams would never sit their number one goalie against the Red Wings because that was just something you just didn't do.
Right.
Whether it was out of reverence or out of
fear.
Respect or whatever.
Yeah.
Fear, yeah. But now, I'm all sit Fleury. We don't need Fleury. Rubbins can't score anyway. What do we need 44? They've got Malkin and Crosby and a bunch of other guys over there that can score goals and generate offense. We don't need to have our number one guy against these guys. This is the second night of a back-to-back. Let's give Fleury the night off. He doesn't need to be. We don't need him to play back-to-back games. That's how far the Rubbins have fallen. I'm not going to buy this injury thing. I mean, I know that they're banged up. What I'm saying to you is that even before all these injuries hit, when they were pretty healthy in the first month or so of the season, their roster makeup is just, you look at their roster, there's outside of Zetterberg and Datsyuk, there aren't a lot of guys, Al, who can put the puck in the net.
Mm-hmm.
They just aren't.
Yeah.
Now, there's obviously, Tatar is exciting. Nyquist is exciting. But those guys are still young, and they're still feeling their way, and they're going to have bad nights more than they're going to have good right now at this stage of their career. Cleary's been a huge disappointment. Weiss has been a huge disappointment. Michael Samuels has been a huge disappointment. And these are all guys, with the exception of Weiss, who are starting to get a little long in the tooth. And, it's just really, I know they missed to Kaiser. He's a good, moves the puck out of the zone and what have you. I know that Brendan Smith has been a pleasant surprise, and he's been playing well on the back end. But, Al, you need, and this when goal scoring isn't such a premium anymore, you need guys who can, you can count on for 20 to 25 goals. And the Red Wings, aside from Datsyuk and Zetterberg, just don't have that. And as much as I love Darren Helm, and I love what he brings to the team, he's just not that. He's not a 20-29 goal scorer either.
Mm.
He's a guy that's going to, he's a pest. He's got a lot of speed. He can make things happen with that speed. I love Darren Helm. Love him to death. But he's just not, it's too much to ask him to be a scorer. Todd Bertuzzi, where's he been?
Mm-hmm.
I know he's been hurt a little bit too, but he's not doing anything. I mean, I think what's happening now is they're getting old fast,
yeah.
and that's what's scary. I mean, real fast, on the front end for sure. And the young guys that they've got to bring in to try to stem that a little bit, it's just asking too much of them right now to make up all that goal scoring that they're losing. And it's going to be, I think we're going to be ready. I think we're already seeing it, frankly. A dry spell where it's going to be, the Red Wings are just going to be like a middle of the road team for a while until they they're not going to be able to just trade their way out of this and free agent sign their way out of this. They've got to start developing players, and as much as I've been a fan of Ken Hollins, Al, if you really want to take a hard look at the Red Wings organization the last 5 to 7 years, they have not really produced, from their homegrown system, a lot of blue chip guys. They really haven't.
Yeah.
And Red Wings fans don't want to really talk about that because it's like the elephant in the room. But really, their player development recently has not been very good. And they have not really produced players from their own, that they've drafted and that they've homegrown
mm-hmm.
into very good NHL players. Let's face it, they just
yeah.
haven't.
Yeah.
And that is part of the reason why you're seeing them, you know, this whole, you're fooling yourself if you think that they're retooling because they're rebuilding. Because their old guys are getting too old too fast, and the young guys just aren't able to keep up.
All right, let's move on from the Red Wings real quick. So we're running out of time. We wanted to touch on a historic day in NBA history, which was a couple days ago, December 13th, 1983, where the Pistons topped the Nuggets, Greg, 186 to 184 in two overtimes. I remember watching this game, as a matter of fact. It's the highest scoring game in NBA history at 370 points. And really, as we mentioned earlier, it's a record that likely won't be challenged anytime soon, if ever. To think about it, Greg, to look at today's scoring, you know, the game is slower. It's not nearly as fast-paced as it was back then. And obviously defense was, the NBA, especially back then, was not known as a defensive league. That kind of changed with the Pistons later in that decade. But the challenge record today, a game would have to probably go six overtimes, at least. And these two teams were able to do it in two. And to put it in perspective, they scored 186 points, yet those Pistons averaged 117 points a game, and they were also number one in offensive efficiency. And this was the era of the Kelly Chirpuka and Isaiah Thomas won two Pistons, and they were a very entertaining team to watch, Greg. And what I found was the most interesting fact of this game is that out of all the points scored, there was only one three-point basket, which really says – just how up and down and how fast this game went.
Wow.
And
that
three-pointer didn't come until the second overtime. It was Isaiah Thomas. And
that's amazing.
Four players scored over 40 points. Kelly Chirpuka added 35. And Dan Issel, I mean, you talk about blasts from the past, these names, you know, John Long, Kiki Vandeweghe, Alex English,
right.
You know, all
yeah.
these guys who had huge scoring nights. And both teams shot 56%.
Wow.
Yeah, so
That's amazing.
I kind of missed that NBA because that era of Pistons, even though they were just becoming what they were going to be, goddamn, they were a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, it's ironic because one of the reasons that Jack McCloskey fired Scotty Robertson, that was Chuck Daly's first year, by the way, as a
mm-hmm.
Pistons coach. One of the reasons why McCloskey fired Scotty Robinson is that he was unhappy with the way the Pistons were playing defense.
Yeah.
It was a different kind of an NBA, like you said, yeah. back then. But as Chuck, you know, kind of sunk his knee hooks into the team,
mm-hmm.
They eventually did play the kind of defense that does win championships, and the league did change, and a lot of that changing was because of the Pistons, of course, themselves. But the fact that I did not know that until you just told me that there was only one three-point basket in that,
yeah.
out of that all those points is amazing,
mm-hmm.
And it's even more amazing when you think that now with teams using the 3-point shot so much, that it's still going to be difficult, if impossible, for that record to be broken, even in this day and age where
yeah.
teams are throwing up 25 to 30 3-point shots a night. You're still not going to see, because it's not a run and gun. All this has to do with possessions, Alex. How many
mm-hmm.
possessions can you squeeze in to a 48-minute game? And the number of possessions, you mentioned the Pistons averaging 117 points, the number of possessions that you would have in an NBA game in 1983
mm-hmm.
is way more.
Yeah.
Than you see in 2013. It's kind of why you'll never see a 30-game winner in baseball anymore, because now you've got the five-man rotation.
Mm-hmm.
There just aren't enough starts for a guy to win 30 games.
Yeah.
And now there's just not enough possessions in an NBA game, which is where teams use darn near almost all 24 seconds of the shot clock. There just aren't that many possessions for you to even consider approaching that record. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a different game. Certainly than it was back then, and I also remember watching that game. I came home from work. I was working a job in Ann Arbor at a
mm-hmm.
drugstore. I came home from work around 11:30, and a game was played in Denver. It probably started around 9:30.
Right.
So I caught like the end of regulation and all the overtimes. And I, when I turned the game on, I saw what the score was. Because even for that period of the NBA, that was a high scoring
game. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness gracious. But it's funny because I don't recall, you know, I didn't, you know, really think of the lack of a three-pointer. But, my goodness, to think that there was only one is amazing.
Yeah, but and say what you will about, you know, how the Pistons gradually became a defensive force. Those Pistons could still score a lot of points. They put up good offensive numbers. And I you know, and sometimes watching this current era of Pistons, it just kind of feels like drudgery watching these guys on offense sometimes. Just the, there's a lot of, you know, like I said, we've talked about in the past that, you know, there seems to be some, they're still trying to figure things out. They're a couple of games under 500. They got three big men that are trying to figure out the spacing and how each guy is going to be most effectively used. And but just thinking back to those Pistons, you know, and they were at the same, they were under 500 at the time. They were in many ways much like today's Pistons. They were building something, but obviously they had the building block in Isaiah Thomas. But man, that. It just brings back just really fond memories, Greg, of just how much fun watching the Pistons of the 80s were from really the dregs of the NBA to one of the most entertaining teams in the NBA who still had issues to finally NBA champions. And I kind of miss that NBA. I really do.
I do, too. Yeah. I really do.
All right, let's wrap up the show, Greg. So it's time for our jerk of the week. Who's gotten your goat? So I'll let you lead off. Who's got your goat? Who's your jerk?
Well, I don't even know this guy's name. Who's the guy who called Calvin Johnson old on the Baltimore Ravens? Whoever that idiot was who called Calvin Johnson old, that safety for the Ravens, why you would stir up, why you would, you know, go into a hornet's nest and stir that up, I have no idea. But that guy's a dimwit, and he's a jerk. Just because he's an idiot. I mean, I don't know why you would say things like disparaging about the best receiver in the game to get him even more fired up for a game that your team needs to win very badly on the road on Monday Night Football. Now I know that, you know, I'm sure he's a good guy, but, you know, he said a very stupid thing. And why you would give another team bulletin board material like that. So my trick of the week is whoever that safety was for the Ravens who called Calvin Johnson old last week.
And it was his name is Matt Elam, by the way.
Elam, right. Yeah, Elam, right.
All right. My jerk of the week is I'm going back to the concussion issue, and I'm going to go with Pete Rose for for various reasons. But obviously, when this came up, people immediately thought of Pete Rose because of what happened in 1970. And Pete Rose immediately went into the, you know, this is, you know, old school baseball, and you know, they're wussifying the game, and all players shouldn't have to do that. And of course, completely ignoring the fact that he essentially ended a player's career because of a player at the plate, and that play was in a meaningless exhibition game. The All-Star game, you know, didn't even count for anything back then.
Right.
Ray Fosse, who was an all-star catcher for the Indians, Rose ran him over, ruined the guy's shoulder. He ended up playing, I think, 9 years, but he was never the same player. Fosse went from an all-star to essentially becoming a journeyman because of Pete Rose's, people would rave about Pete Rose's will to win. But there's a line you cross from being doing what it takes to win to out and out injuring somebody for no reason. And so Pete Rose is the last person anybody would want to defend catcher collisions. So my jerk of the week is Pete Rose because, well, he's Pete Rose.
Good enough.
All right.
I want to thank Adam Biggers for another edition of Adam Rants, and I want to remind everybody that you can check him out at BleacherReport.com. You can read me at GregEno.com. Follow me on Twitter at GregEno. Follow the Neatrix on Twitter at the Neatrix. Our Facebook fan page is facebook.com/TheNatrix, and our blog is natrix.us. Check out my reverence blog, thewingedwheeler.wordpress.com as well. I want to thank my lovely wife, Sharon, and thank you, Big Dal, for making money during this discussion.
Indeed, Greg. I appreciate you taking the time, as always. I want to also let you know where you can find me online. Always look for me at Bless You Boys, writing about the Tigers and baseball pretty much every day at blessyouboys.com. I'm also on Twitter, at Bless You Boys. Look for Bless You Boys on Facebook. It's Facebook.com/BYB.Tigers. And, of course, be on the lookout for the Blessing Boys podcast. We're going to do a Christmas episode this coming week. And you want to hear our take about the winter meetings? We just did 4 episodes during every day of the winter meetings. Go to blessyouboys.com. Also, you can find it on Twitter and the usual places where you can find podcasts, along where you can find this podcast as well. So, until this time next week where we, I guess we'll celebrate Christmas. This is Al Beaton saying good night, good luck, and aloha.
Shout out to everybody. See you.